So what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The International Monetary Fund issued its latest world economic outlook, cutting its growth forecast this year to 3.2 from 3.4%. Maurice Obstfeld is the IMF's chief economist.
In many countries, the lack of wage growth and greater inequality have created widespread senses that economic growth has mainly been to the benefit of economic elites and mobile capital that they've gained disproportionately, leaving too many others behind. Lower growth reinforces this turn toward inward-looking, nationalistic attitudes.
The IMF says the U.S., Japan, European Union, and Southern Africa will all grow more slowly than previously expected this year. It said China's weakness has had a spillover effect. The global lending agency cites continued violent instability in places like Syria, the surge of refugees to Europe, and the possible British exit from the European Union as potentially damaging to the fragile global economy. China Wednesday said its exports surged nearly 12% in March to around $160 billion, a positive sign for the world's second biggest economy. Imports, meanwhile, slipped nearly 2%, while the trade surplus surged to more than 13 times the amount reported this time last year. Kenya has deported another group of Taiwan nationals to China after a similar action prompted Taiwan to accuse Beijing of kidnapping. The group of Taiwanese was arrested in Kenya in 2014 and charged with cybercrime, but cleared in a court. Now Reuters reports the group was suspected of fraud of Chinese consumers in an alleged telecom scheme operated out of Kenya. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Tuesday in Los Angeles proclaimed the benefits of two major U.S. free trade deals that have become campaign issues here in the U.S., the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Mr. Kerry said both have broad benefits that include defending U.S. strategic interests and strengthening national security, but acknowledged many Americans in this election year feel anxiety about those agreements.
They've been revved up to have some anxiety about anything related to trade. Now, some of that trust, unfortunately, comes from politicians who play to fears. It also comes from legitimate anger about the economic status of millions of our fellow citizens who have not gained through trade. And frankly, I understand that anger.
Critics of the trade agreements insist they'll cost American jobs. The TPP, involving 11 other Pacific Rim countries, still faces congressional approval. The TTIP is still being negotiated. No fewer than eight governments have put forward candidates for UN Secretary General, half of them women. Tuesday, the UN opened 3 days of extraordinary public hearings, and candidates fielded questions on global issues. Among those candidates, Portuguese Prime Minister Antonio Guterres, who said his priority would be prevention.
We are spending 70% of our resources in peacekeeping, and in peacekeeping where there is no peace to keep. We are seeing the impacts of climate change. We are seeing the problems of inequality and lack of inclusivity in development in many parts of the world. So with an holistic approach, which means to address the three pillars of the UN activity from a prevention perspective, is clearly my personal priority.
Guterres in December stepped down as head of the UN Refugee Agency. Current UN Chief Ban Ki-moon's tenure ends next January. Voting is underway in South Korea's parliamentary elections. To gauge public sentiment ahead of next year's presidential race, this is the first general election since President Park Geun-hye was sworn into office. The co-chairman of the opposition People's Party, Ahn Cheol-soo, said he awaits the judgment of the people. Rising unemployment, plunging exports, and high levels of household debt have led to criticism of Ms. Park's handling of the economy. The rights group Amnesty International is calling for an investigation following the revelation Monday by a Kaduna state official in Nigeria that nearly 350 bodies of minority Shia Muslims were buried in mass graves following clashes with soldiers in December. Amnesty said this is an important first step in bringing charges against those suspected of wrongdoing. Officials in Burundi say at least five were killed, six wounded, when gunmen opened fire at a marketplace late Monday. The unidentified gunmen are believed to be associated with exiles in Tanzania, led by a former presidential spokesman who was fired last year for advising President Pierre Nkurunziza not to seek a third term. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The deputy leader of South Sudan rebels returned to Juba.
Peace means our people should be free to talk their minds. Peace means freedom to express your mind, gather together, to express yourself, even if it means you disagree.
General Afriladu Gore is the deputy chairman of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. Zambian police arrest two journalists for defamation of President Edgar Lungu. The UN reports an alarming rise in Boko Haram child suicide bombers, and Liberian teachers threaten nationwide strike if their government goes ahead with a proposed public-private education partnership.
The resolution was passed today by the Representative Council. There will be a nationwide strike if they continue to impose something that we know is not feasible, it is not sustainable, and it is a violation of our constitution and education laws.
Samuel Johnson is the Senior Secretary General of the National Teachers Association of Liberia. It has been 2 years since Boko Haram abducted more than 200 Chibok girls. And Somalia's Prime Minister supports a campaign against female genital mutilation. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The deputy leader of South Sudan rebels returned to Juba yesterday along with dozens of other opposition officials. General Afriladu Gore's arrival comes a week before rebel leader Riek Machar's arrival. He was welcomed by South Sudan government officials. As Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba, General Gore said his arrival reaffirms that peace in South Sudan cannot be reversed.
Dressed in a black suit, a white shirt, and a pink tie, Lieutenant General Afriladu Gore emerged from a plane chartered by the Kenyan government. Gore says he came back to Juba to support full implementation of the peace agreement.
Peace will not be reversed. We must move forward with our country. And this is the momentous challenge which we have for us to be together, to work together, to find solutions to the problem.
Gore's arrival comes after last batch of 1,370 SPLA-I officers arrived in Juba over the weekend as part of transitional security arrangement for Juba town. SPLM-IO spokesman William Ezekiel says Ladu and his delegation are ready to go to work.
We have resolved to be together and to continue with our effort to rebuild this country. It's very important that this country must occupy its place among the free nations of the world.
Akol Paul Akordit, a member of the National Assembly and a member of the SPLM Political Bureau, was the only government official to greet Gore at the airport.
His arrival today signifies that indeed the war has come to an end and that the suffering inflicted on the people of South Sudan by this unwanted war will be brought to an end. And that peace shall reign once again in this country.
Ezekiel says government security agents arrested and detained 16 SPLM-IO officials who were mobilizing civilians to receive Gore at the airport. Gore condemned the arrest, calling them a breach on freedom.
That is unfortunate and should not recur, shouldn't, because peace means our people should be free to talk their minds. Peace means freedom to express your mind, gather together, to express yourself, even if it means you disagree. But it is a very unfortunate incident. I deplore it and I condemn it.
Paul Akordit denies knowing anything about the incident. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Liberian school teachers are threatening a nationwide strike if their government goes ahead with a proposed public-private education partnership. Samuel Johnson, Senior Secretary General of the National Teachers Association of Liberia, says the teachers approved the strike resolution on Tuesday. Liberia's Education Minister George Werner told VOA the government is not privatizing the nation's public education system. Rather, he said, it is entering into a public-private partnership because the current performance level of Liberian schools requires drastic action. But Johnson says the proposed partnership is not feasible, sustainable, and it violates Liberia's constitution and education laws. He says the teachers have asked the national legislature to stop the education minister from implementing the proposed project.
they signed a memorandum of understanding with the British International Academy that have four performance records in East Africa where they have been performing in 404 schools. Based on our research, we told him that it was not feasible to have this British International Academy to come and teach children using tablets. Less than 3% of our population have access to electricity. Then we don't have internet facility in most of our schools. You can only have these type of lessons when you have Wi-Fi available in the schools. This is not the case in Liberia. Kenya have advanced technology more than us. They have 24-hour electricity, and yet British International Academy is underperforming there. It will be a disservice, and it will bring segregation in the school system.
As you know, I spoke with the Minister of Education, Mr. Werner, and he said that given the current education system, the time is now for change. He talked about poor performance of the school system. He also mentioned that perhaps people like your organization are rejecting to this because you want business as usual.
It is not business as usual. The purpose of the breach has hidden motives behind it. This is what we are opposing, because the fund that they are going to use for the public-private partnership, if you stay into the current system, you will see greater improvement. The facts are there.
How would you compare the funding that this current system is getting to the funding that this public-private venture is getting?
The current funding is very less. Our education law requires that 25% of the national budget should be allocated to education. But this is not the case. For several years, the budget allocated for the education sector have been between 9 to 13%. We have told them the fact. If you want to outsource any aspect of the Ministry of Education, outsource the supervision. Look for an expert that can come and train.
So, Mr. Johnson, it seems to me the Minister of Education and the Ministry of Education and the government are going ahead with this project. What are you going to do as the National Teachers Association?
We have taken the issue to the national legislature because it's a violation of our constitution, Article 6, and education laws. We are waiting for the reaction from the national legislature. And the civil society organization that are associated with education in this country are deciding to take legal action to issue a writ or injunction on the entire process. We cannot continue to run our school system on trial and error basis. It is a violation of the laws. This is our main concern. Then it is not sustainable. If you don't listen, that's the next option. We nationwide strike. The resolution was passed today by the Representative Council, the highest decision-making body of our association. There'll be a nationwide strike if they continue to impose something that we know is not feasible, it is not sustainable, and it is a violation of our constitution and education laws.
Samuel Johnson is Senior Secretary General of the National Teachers Association of Liberia. You are speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The United Nations Children's Fund reports a sharp rise in the use of child suicide bombers by the Nigeria-based militant group Boko Haram. UNICEF says 75% of the children used in the attacks are girls. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF says the number of known child suicide attacks in Nigeria and neighboring Chad, Cameroon, and Niger spiked to 44 last year, up from 4 the year before. The agency, however, says it believes the actual numbers are higher. Speaking on a line from Dakar, Senegal, UNICEF's Regional Director for West and Central Africa, Manuel Fontaine, says these children should be considered as victims, not as perpetrators.
In many cases, they might be unaware that they're even carrying a bomb. In some cases, they've been indoctrinated and they are too young to really understand the consequences of their acts in this case. This whole thing basically creates a sense of fear and suspicion towards children, which is really a very unnatural feeling.
Fontaine says deceiving children and forcing them to carry out deadly acts is one of the most horrific aspects of the violence in Nigeria and neighboring countries.
I think what we're also very concerned about is we see increasing stigma towards the children who have been either abducted, used in some cases for girls and women raped and carrying babies of Boko Haram, but also of boys who have been recruited and used by Boko Haram. We're seeing an increased stigma.
The agency says the situation for children in Nigeria and neighboring countries has worsened since Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in Chibok nearly 2 years ago. Since then, it says the militant group has abducted about 2,000 other children from Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. Fontaine says communities are beginning to see children as threats to their safety as suicide attacks involving children become commonplace. He warns this attitude is very damaging and can have destructive consequences for communities that are trying to rebuild their way of life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today is Wednesday, April 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. It has been nearly 2 years since Boko Haram militants stormed the northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok and abducted more than 200 schoolgirls. Outside of propaganda videos created by the Islamist militant group, none of the girls has been seen since. Meanwhile, in Nigeria's remote northeast, the families of the missing girls say they are suffering because of their daughter's absence. VOA's Chris Stein has this report from Mbalala, Nigeria.
The fathers sit in the scant shade at a marketplace in the town of Balala, waiting for their daughters to come home. They're the parents of four of the 219 girls abducted by Boko Haram militants from a school in the nearby community of Chibok nearly 2 years ago. The kidnapping is Boko Haram's most infamous crime. It attracted global condemnation and offers of help finding the girls from Nigeria's allies. Nigeria's military and political leaders continue to pledge that they will rescue the students. For the parents of the missing girls, nothing has been the same since the kidnapping. Whenever he thinks of his missing daughter, Yawale Dunya says he feels feverish and starts shaking. The government secondary school where the kidnapping happened is now a pile of rubble. Boko Haram burned down the girls' dormitory after the kidnapping. The school was later demolished so it could be rebuilt. That has yet to happen, leaving Chibok and the towns around it without a school. The lack of classrooms is just one of the town's troubles. Boko Haram continues to menace the area. Militants briefly overran Chibok in 2014. In January of this year, suicide bombers killed at least 10 people in the town's marketplace. It has taken a toll on the people of Chibok, particularly the families of the missing girls. Yakubu Nkeke, head of an association of parents of the abducted schoolgirls, says 18 mothers and fathers have died since the mass kidnapping.
This kind of incident is to bring a lot of sickness. You know, you are not in peace of mind. You can't have time properly for your feeding. You are living in fear, thinking of your young one in the hand of captors. You know, anything might attack you and easily you lose your life.
In Balala, the families of the missing students seek solace in each other's company. When he is together with his friends and co-workers, Joseph Sanda says he is able to distract himself from thinking about his missing daughter. But when he is alone, she's all he can think about. Chris Stein for VOA News, Balala, Nigeria.
Zambian police on Tuesday arrested two journalists of the privately owned Post newspaper and charged them with defamation of President Edgar Lungu. Ernest Chanda is a member of the Press Freedom Committee of the Post newspaper. He says the journalists were arrested because the Post has been critical of the government. Chanda said the paper published a story a year ago in which an opposition figure alleged that President Lungu went to a nightclub and played pool at taxpayers' expense while he was on holiday.
Three of our journalists appeared at Lusaka Central Police Station. They were summoned to answer to a charge they framed as defamation of the president. This has got to do with a story the Post newspaper published on 9th May 2015, where a leader of an opposition party, a Mr. Eric Chanda, was telling President Edgar Lungu that he should be the last person to complain about his members of staff liking the idea of partying, because for him, from the first day he was inaugurated as president in January last year, the first assignment he did was to go to some resort part of Zambia to go and play pool and have a drink up.
This story, as you indicated, was published last year. Why now did the police find the need to come and rearrest them?
Yeah, that's the question everybody is asking. But of course, the obvious answer is that we are the only media institution that has been very critical of the government, especially in matters of fighting corruption, in matters of bad governance. We've been quite critical of that, and they have not liked it. And just late last week, the Minister of Information threatened that if we continue criticizing them the way we do, they are going to take appeal to Parliament and regulate the media.
Zambia goes to elections coming this August. And
that's
you
right.
said you are a privately owned newspaper. Could it be seen by people in the government that perhaps your criticism is taking the side of the opposition?
Initially, that's what they thought. But as things stand, if you ask independent people, they will tell you that right now we are not siding with any political party. Even the party that they thought we would side with, the biggest opposition party for now, the United Party for National Development, we criticize them almost on a daily basis. Just yesterday, we had an editorial comment which was criticizing that same opposition party, saying that from the look of things, from the policies they have, they do not seem to be so different from the ruling party.
In case your reporters are found guilty, what's the punishment here?
In case they are found guilty, they face a minimum jail sentence of 5 years and a maximum of 7 years. Actually, this is an old law that was left by the British government when they colonized the then Northern Rhodesia, which is now Zambia. It was somehow some kind of trying to intimidate the black Africans not to speak against Her Majesty's government at the time.
Ernest Chanda is a member of the Press Freedom Committee of the Post newspaper of Zambia. He was speaking with me from Lusaka, a Somali refugee who fled her nation's civil war at age 17, is due to return to advise the government on ending the practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM, a cultural or religious practice carried out in large parts of Africa and the Middle East. Viewers Henry Richwell spoke to Ifra Ahmed ahead of a trip and reports from London.
98% of Somali girls and women between the ages of 15 and 49 have undergone female genital mutilation, according to the United Nations, making it the country with the highest prevalence in the world. Anti-FGM campaigner Ifra Ahmed last month persuaded Somalia's Prime Minister Omar Abdirashid Ali Sharmak to add his signature to a 1 million strong petition calling for a ban.
Not only that to sign, but he promised that he will be supporting the campaign and he will support within the parliament before end of the year to bring the legislation.
Ahmed herself was forced to undergo FGM as a young girl. She fled Somalia's civil war in 2006 and now lives in Ireland, but is due to return to her home country next month to become the Prime Minister's advisor on gender issues. Part of her job will be to develop an FGM eradication program.
Young women die for bleeding, have kidney infection, a lot of different problems. And also some women, they die because of childbirth. And I say this is the reason I get involved. And some men, they sit and they listen, and then they start arguing. Some of them, they say, well, you know, that is kind of Western culture that you've been taking, and now you want to make it and tell us what you've been told in Western countries.
Somali government troops, alongside African Union and Kenyan forces, are battling Islamist al-Shabaab militants who continue to stage sporadic attacks. Ahmed says she hides her European background when visiting communities.
There are a lot of organizations based in Somalia who are talking on FGM, but there is no really grassroots that people are going places to do the work because of the the situation in Somalia, the whole thing is the war. Everybody is scared.
Despite global pledges to end FGM, the United Nations estimates more than 130 million girls and women alive in the world today have undergone the practice. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ullman in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with football. Hosts and African champions Nigeria Super Falcons dismissed Senegal 2-0 in the return leg of their 2016 Africa Women's Cup of Nations qualifier in the capital Abuja on Tuesday. Nigeria advanced courtesy of a 3-1 advantage. Ghana outclassed Tunisia in Accra 4-0 to prevail on a 6-1 aggregate. South Africa dismissed visitors Botswana 3-0 in Johannesburg to advance on a 5-0 advantage. Meanwhile, Kenya will make their debut at the Women's Nations Cup following their 1-1 draw against visitors Algeria in Nairobi. In the opening leg, Kenya held Algeria 2-2 in Algiers. Although they tie 3-3 on aggregate, Kenya progressed on the away goal rule. Consequently, Ghana, Kenya, South Africa and defending champions Nigeria join Egypt, Equatorial Guinea, Zimbabwe and hosts Cameroon, who had already qualified for the Women's Nations Cup. Meanwhile, FIFA has disqualified Equatorial Guinea from the preliminary football competition for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, FIFA disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland. According to the FIFA disciplinary committee, Equatorial Guinea fielded an ineligible player, Camila Mario do Carmo Nobre de Oliveira, during their 2016 Olympic football campaign. FIFA has also imposed a fine of over $20,000 on the Equatorial Guinea Football Association. Furthermore, De Oliveira is suspended from playing in Equatorial Guinea's next 10 international matches, and she will pay a fine of over $2,000. On a more cheerful note, the Togo International Cycling Tour enters its second day today, Wednesday. The six-day contest, which started in the capital Lome, features cyclists from Belgium, Benin, Burkina Faso, the Democratic Republic of Congo, France, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Mali, Nigeria, Netherlands, and hosts Togo. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, April 13th.
Dear viewer, please permit me to congratulate the Rwandan government on the occasion of their 22nd remembrance of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. For those people that died during that genocide, may their soul and the souls of the faithful departed rest in peace with the Lord. Comrade Mazi Patrick Okoro Krafo, of Blue Premises, at an Arutuku in Abia State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's it for this Wednesday, April 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We ask you to join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the International Criminal Court and African leaders, as well as ICC's ruling on Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.